Welcome to the Resistance Roundtable, which comes to you the second Saturday of each month at 10 a.m. and offers a space for the discussion and listener calls on the unprecedented and sometimes disturbing political developments of the past couple of weeks. And let's get started by introducing our regular panelists, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, who teaches in the English department at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors. Welcome, Ruth.
Hi.
Good to see you. Scott Harris, the host of Counterpoint on WPKN, and he's also the producer of Between the Lines radio news magazine. Scott?
Good morning, Richard.
Glad you could make it. And my name is Richard Hill, host of First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio and the Organic Farm Stand on WPKN. So today we'll be hearing by phone, as usual, one of our special features, about 15 minutes or so from Joe Marcellaro, who is a member of Rise and Resist in New York City. She'll be talking about the widespread activism against the Republican tax bill, which awaits final action in Congress. And as usual, we'll welcome your phone calls, and we'll reserve the second half of the show for those starting at around 10:30. So please call in with your input, and I'll give that number now, and we'll give it later, but it's 203-336-9756. So, as our usual practice, according to our usual practice, let's check in with our panel. I hope that we're all sufficiently shell-shocked to have generated enough adrenaline to have a lively discussion today. Ruth, what have you been focusing on?
I think we're experiencing the death of a thousand cuts simultaneously. It seems as if everywhere you turn, you're under attack. I've been noticing for some time that if something has the word public in its name, the Republicans will be doggedly trying to destroy or privatize it. I want to just list a few. Note the terms: public education, public parks, public airwaves, public roads, public utilities, public library, public lands, public service, public works, public transportation, public assistance, public office, public health, and, of course, the United States Post Office. The current Congress and President seem to have ratcheted up these efforts to loot the public coffers, either indirectly by undermining public services and turning to the private sector, which they falsely claim is more efficient and economical, or directly by transferring wealth, as they are doing with the present tax reform bill, which will be immediately followed by entitlement reform to pay for the tax reform. Every cabinet and agency appointment under this administration has been a person actively opposed to the mission of the department. Who picked these people? Trump certainly did not know them and would not have had the patience or know-how to seek out such a thorough pack of scoundrels. My suspicion is that this was one of the jobs of Steve Bannon, he of the tear down the government and replace it with a new model, Breitbartian agenda. I'm particularly distressed about what's happening, the assault on public lands right now. And I think this is a really interesting follow-up to the last hour's program on Native American concerns. The most egregious venture against public lands was last week's declaration by Donald Trump that two national monuments, read public lands, in Utah, known as the Grand Staircase Escalante, set aside by Bill Clinton in 1996, and Bears Ears, created by Barack Obama in 2016. Under advice supposedly by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, Trump has announced that Grand Staircase Escalante will be reduced by 50% and the remaining land broken into three pieces, and Bears Ears will be reduced by 85%. He claims that the states should manage public lands and sell or lease as they choose for oil, coal, and gas exploration using pristine open lands of ecological value, sacred sites, and archaeologically sensitive locations to increase our supply of carbon fuels. Five Indian nations have petitioned to protect Bears Ears. Conservation groups have filed suit to protect Grand Staircase Escalante. These suits should delay any change for many months, according to observers, and the Indian nations believe that this kind of assault is ultimately going to be declared unconstitutional. We can only hope. Some time ago, there were cheap motels and tourist traps on the brink of the Grand Canyon. That's what happens when commercial interests are permitted to help themselves to celebrate free enterprise as they choose. Somebody gets rich and the land is changed, often forever. The Koch brothers have long wanted to acquire tracts of public lands. Oil companies seem to think an undrilled acre is a wasted acre. Ranchers want to lease lands for grazing their herds, and some of them, like Clive and Bundy in 2014, have refused to pay their rents and tried to deny U.S. authorities access. We're also looking at an assault on net neutrality. Full and equal public access to the Internet is in the Trump crosshairs as the FCC Chairman Ajit Pai moves to repeal the net neutrality rules put in place by President Obama, claiming neutrality hampers investment and takes control away from Internet service providers who could otherwise give us the same pay-based hierarchy we have from our cable programming providers, using speed pay scales and per platform and site paywalls to privilege some communications over others on the basis of who's able to pay. Pai has declared that he will not consider public statements filed in response to this plan. Considering the importance of the Internet for education, news access, and, of course, political organizing, this is an assault on the public's right to know, their freedom of speech, and their freedom of assembly. Woody Guthrie knew what he was singing, and it's time for us to join the chorus of "This land is your land, this land is my land. Resist." That's my report for the morning.
I think focusing there on net neutrality is a good way of kind of putting the icing on the cake of the attacks on free speech, the democratic processes in our country that have been raging since January 20th, and, you know, including attacks on the mainstream media, voting rights, the right to dissent and to demonstrate. We see with the horrendous prosecutions of people in D.C. for the inaugural demonstrations, on and on and on. And now finally trying to snuff out independent media and independent voices through closing down the Internet. It's the full spectrum dominance is what's happening. Scott, what have you been, particular nettle is lodged in your frontal lobe at the moment?
What could I possibly add to that long list of noxious and vile things that are going on every day? It's just hard to put your head around this thing. It's just amazing how many areas of government, and as you said, Ruthanne, anything with the word public in it is under just mortal attack.
Except, of course, Republican. That's out of bounds, I guess.
Yeah, it's just dizzying what's going on. But this particular story that I've been following, and many of our listeners, I'm sure, are aware of it, involves reports from BuzzFeed and the Intercept. It's a story about how the Trump administration is considering a proposal for a private company, Amintor Group, to set up a large intelligence network and run counter-terrorist propaganda efforts. The Intercept reports the plan was developed by Eric Prince, founder of the notorious Blackwater private security firm Mercenaries, which was deemed to be guilty of massacres in Iraq when they were hired by the Pentagon to run some operations there. And also involved in this project is Oliver North, Colonel Oliver North, infamous from the Iran-Contra days, who lied to Congress and just threw a pardon from George Bush, escaped prison. At any rate, their plan is an outgrowth of Prince's proposal floated earlier this year to privatize U.S. covert operations in Afghanistan along the lines of what Eric Prince described as something like the East India Company. The East India Company was authorized by the British Crown way back when to plunder China and India and other places in Southeast Asia, basically in exchange for being the police on the beat for the British monarchy. And that was what Eric Prince was proposing, was to be able to plunder the resources of Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever else they were going to be. It's an amazing proposal. But at any rate, the goal of this idea of a private CIA for Trump was to give Mike Pompeo in the White House a global private spy network that would circumvent official U.S. intelligence agencies. It would be a direct action arm, totally off the books, and the intelligence shared would be shared with the rest of the CIA or the larger intelligence community. Excuse me, they would not be shared. It wouldn't be shared at all. So this would be like his own private, dare I say it, well, I won't say it. I don't like the Nazi metaphor, so I won't get into it. The prospect of a private CIA run by an authoritarian president who's either ignorant or contemptuous of criminal law is an ominous development. It's also hardly, it's also not, you know, all that foreign to this government. After all, there was back in the Iran-Contra days, as Oliver North's presence can attest, this private off-the-books network of spies and covert operators. So it's something that would be not all that foreign to what the government has done before, but in the hands of Trump, it makes it all that more alarming. And the interesting thing is the White House initially denied it as if it was just a made-up story, fake news. But, however, they walked that back. They actually, in some press statements, you know, used the semantics in order to say, well, you know, it's not under serious consideration at this time. So it was proposed, as reported, and who knows where this is going to head.
Yeah, and it comes together with this rhetorical assault on the intelligence agencies in the United States, the deep state in general, but also not specifically the FBI, where in the past week, this bizarre spectacle of Republicans, Donald Trump, and other cabinet members literally naming individual FBI agents in front of congressional hearings and saying, did they betray any loyalty to Hillary Clinton anywhere along? I mean, it's just insane. And basically questioning the methodology and the motivation of the FBI, which progressives such as ourselves, are now in the position of having to defend, which is rather ironic. So thanks, Scott. I'm going to revisit an issue that I've actually talked about a couple of times on the show, and that is the issue of the crisis on the Korean Peninsula. But I'll start with quoting Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a retired military man who served in the Korean Peninsula in the 1990s under Bill Clinton. He was part of the joint military exercises that we see happening every 3 months or so still. And I just want to quote a couple of things he said in a recent interview with Paul Jay of The Real News. And this is Wilkerson speaking. He says, giving some perspective on the point of view or the defensive posture, as he regards it, of Pyongyang and Kim Jong-un. He says, you're sitting in Pyongyang. You're looking south. You see the 7th Fleet. You see 600,000 well-trained and equipped South Korean troops. You see missiles bristling all over. Now you see the THAAD, which is the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, which was just installed by Trump. You see Japan. You see everything the United States can bring to bear in addition to South Korea's own military. And you are scared. It's that clear. And so what he's suggesting here is that North Korea is adopting a defensive posture, and that's what their nuclear program is about. He says, if we wanted to do something meaningful, not just beating our chests like Donald Trump likes to do, we could start talks with North Korea and get back on the same track we were on in 1994. He's referring to the joint framework, I think it's called, where we would offer things to North Korea and they would offer things in exchange. For example, cease your missile and nuclear weapons testing and we'll cease our military exercises in the South. Now, interestingly, this past week, I found an article in the Washington Examiner written by Joel Gierke, I think his name is, dated December 1st. He says, quoting the article, North Korea is willing to negotiate with the United States on its nuclear program as long as Russia plays a role in these talks, according to a Russian lawmaker. And quoting further, North Korea is currently ready to conduct negotiations with the U.S. with the participation of Russia as a third party, Vitaly Pashin, a member of the Russian legislature, told state-run media following a trip to the Korean Peninsula. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's team has refused to consider direct talks with North Korea until the regime starts testing ballistic missiles and agrees that the negotiations would result in the loss of its nuclear weapons. So in other words, North Korea is expected to give it all up, and then we can talk. But basically, giving it all up would be the goal of the talk. So it's really quite back-ass words, so to speak. To quote further from, I believe it's Vitaly Pashin, the North Korean leadership noted that the country is regularly subjected to external aggression on the part of the United States. According to the North Korean representative, they are forced to demonstrate the ability to adequately respond to any aggression from the U.S., the ability to strike at any territory in America. This is, and by the way, these missile launches he talks about now, he says, this is the first missile launch since the last one carried out by North Korea on September 15th. Since then, Pyongyang has refrained from military provocation for 75 days, awaiting reciprocal steps from the U.S., which instead of meeting North Korea halfway, announced large-scale surprise military drills. And that's what's been going on, right? So the United States keeps marching out 30,000 troops and displaying, you know, their unparalleled military might with warships and flyovers and potentially nuclear armed planes. And somehow we expect North Korea to be all warm and chummy and ready to have a nice chat about giving up their nuclear program. So I think it's interesting that Colonel Wilkerson, and that his interview was in late September, is presaging this development, which, by the way, has gotten absolutely no coverage in any other media outlet. I've searched pretty thoroughly and found no other reference to this conversation by Vitaly Pashin, who's, again, a member of the Russian legislature. And let's remember that the condition that North Korea is asking for is the involvement of Russia in a three-way conversation. And once again, we go back to that issue of the new Cold War, where the notion of having Russia involved in anything that might lead to a constructive solution is considered anathema. And the neocons have neoconned Donald Trump into adopting, I think, a probably very intolerant attitude towards those kinds of cooperations with Russia. That's it. That's, again, collateral damage from the Cold War, the neocon Cold War that's now being waged.
I think you're right about the reluctance to collaborate, involve anybody else. But I think it's typical of Trump, and not that unusual for various periods of American foreign negotiations. Any time we're trying to find a treaty, it seems, or many of the times, like with Iran, for example. What we ask is that we get everything we want, and then we will negotiate. And what we'd be negotiating at that point, it's hard to figure out. But this goes over very well with the people who think that the bully pulpit means you're supposed to be a bully.
Well said. And you know, it's also, just as a footnote, some military and foreign policy analysts, in fact, they're lining up right now, more and more of them, are suggesting that we can live with a nuclear-armed North Korea, and in fact, at this stage, we really have no choice. How are we going to change the facts on the ground, so to speak, to use a term used in the Israeli-Palestine conflict? So what would be the problem in just saying, okay, we have one more member of the nuclear community, and we have to use deterrence in order to keep everybody in their place?
Right now, we're going to turn the page, and welcome to our program, Joe Macciarolo. She's an activist and organizer with the group Rise and Resist, based in New York City. Joe, thanks for making time to come on our program tonight.
Hey, no problem. Happy to be here.
So you're on the air here with myself, Scott Harris, and our panel, Richard Hill and Ruthanne Baumgartner. And Joe, maybe I could ask you, first of all, just say a word about Rise and Resist and the work that you've been doing surrounding the proposed Republican tax legislation, which is now in conference committee and will likely come up for a vote in both the House and Senate, in some kind of final version of this legislation that, by all accounts, is going to hurt the middle class is going to hurt poor folks, is going to defund the government, going to make major cuts to programs like Medicare and Medicaid and down the road Social Security as well. But Joe, tell us about what you've been working on.
Sure. So Rise and Resist is a New York City-based group. We were formed in response to the 2016 election just over a year ago. And we work on any government act that's threatening democracy, equality, or civil liberties. And right now, one of our major focuses is obviously the tax bill. Things we've been working on include hub dialing. So that's a way that we are able to get people across the country involved, because since we're based in New York City, our representatives are mostly very Democratic. So we've been having hub dialing parties where people are actually calling progressive voters who live in Republican majority areas and connecting them with their representatives to speak with their representatives about why the tax bill would be harmful and asking them to vote against it. And besides that, we've had some street protests and other actions in New York City. Last weekend, Trump actually was having a fundraiser in downtown Manhattan. So we held a large street protest across the street.
So you also have been involved in nonviolent civil disobedience in Washington as well, as I understand
it? Yes. Yes. A group of us joined Housing Works and Center for Popular Democracy a few times over the past few weeks to do civil disobedience in the Senate and in some of the House buildings, where a lot of us were arrested sitting outside the offices of representatives trying to actually talk with them. But, you know, of course, they don't usually come out and speak with us. So we would use something called the people's mic, which is when somebody speaks and then everybody else repeats what they say, so that hopefully the representatives are able to hear what we're saying. And some of our members also went into the Senate budget meeting and disrupted it.
How many people have been arrested down in Washington, estimate, from your group and from other groups?
So the last time we went was this past Tuesday, and the overall number of people who were arrested on that day was 125. And I'd say maybe 20 were Rise and Resist members. But it's been an ongoing thing. The day before, there were about 20 people arrested. And there's actually another action being planned for next week.
Tell our listeners a bit about your own personal motivation. Is you told me the other day you're a special education teacher in New York City.
Yeah.
But tell us a bit about why you've kind of stepped up to put your freedom on the line by organizing these major civil disobedience protests.
Sure. So, as I said, I am a special education teacher. I teach in a public school in the South Bronx. And there's been a lot of media attention on how this tax bill will be harmful for higher education. I think there's been less about how it will hurt public education. About 45% of funding for public schools comes from property taxes. And especially in places like New York, where the taxes are already very high, the state and local tax deduction kind of helps with that. It helps it hurt less when taxes need to be hiked in order to give more money to schools. In the bill, it repeals the SALT, or the state and local tax deduction, so that either they won't be able to hike the taxes anymore, or it will really, really hurt people living here, where they won't be able to afford to live anymore. So in the end, public education is going to end up being cut pretty dramatically. And additionally, my students, 50% of my students are in foster care, and 100% of my students receive special education services. And also, all of them receive health care through Medicaid. So this tax bill, Paul Ryan has already come out and said that after this bill passes, which will increase the deficit by at least $1 trillion, they're going to cut spending for programs such as Medicaid, Medicare, food stamps, and other welfare programs. So, you know, my students, they will, if Medicaid is cut, they won't be able to receive all of the educational services they need to address their disabilities. They also will potentially lose their health care. So, you know, knowing that this is happening and these students and their families don't necessarily have the ability to stand up to for themselves or to call Congress, you know, some of them might be undocumented. I feel like it is my responsibility to do as much as I can for them.
Joe, this is Richard speaking. I wanted to ask you, are you focusing your activism on the New York Congress people who voted specifically for the tax bill so far, or are you going beyond state boundaries and trying to do these hub calls to other folks? Because I know that these people in blue states, New York and California and Pennsylvania, are vulnerable. The Republicans who voted for the tax bill, because as you say, their own constituents are going to suffer with these changes to the tax law. So I'm just wondering, maybe you could name a couple of names of some of the Republicans that you're focusing on in New York State, but are you going beyond and actually participating in calls to other states as well?
Sure. So, yes, we are definitely focusing on both. I was arrested at Representative Costello's office. So there are a good number of Republicans in New York who are voting against the tax bill, especially on Long Island, like King and Zeldin. They're voting against it because they know it will be horrible, and they know that their constituents will vote them out of office as soon as they get the chance if they vote for it. But there are, I believe, 5 New York Republican representatives who are still planning on voting for the bill. So it's a big push to get constituents to call them and let them know, or to visit their offices and let them know, we are going to vote you out if you vote for this bill. So, you know, you're going to lose your job. Is it worth it? Is that what you want? And then on top of that, we are also trying to engage the rest of the country via the hub dialing and other efforts like that. And when we go down to Washington with Center for Popular Democracy and Housing Works, they actually managed to get people from across the entire country to come down, and we support those people in speaking to their representatives and doing civil disobedience outside the offices of their representatives.
We're speaking with Joe Maturello, and she's an activist and organizer with the group Rise and Resist, based in New York City.
Is there any indication of, you know, we've sort of been told that if you're not a constituent of a given senator or congressperson, that they really are not interested in hearing your opinion. How do you get around that issue? And do you basically try to use a little subterfuge there, or do you think that calls coming from non-constituents also have impact?
So we know that it definitely seems to be more effective to have actual constituents speaking to their representatives, because sometimes when we hold civil disobedience on Capitol Hill in Washington, the representatives will say, oh, well, these aren't even our constituents. They're paid Democrats who are coming here to do this, which is not true, because when we do that, we have people from, like I said, from across the country come in, and sometimes we'll have a group of people from New York supporting those people, just standing behind them while they speak and tell their story and tell their constituents what they feel. So as much as possible, we try to get people who are actually constituents talking, but it also is worth it, because how these people vote will impact the entire country. So it is also worth it for us, I believe, to contact people like Senator Collins, who is now on the fence about how she's going to vote.
Senator Collins from Maine, right?
Yes.
Susan Collins.
Yes.
Yeah, that flaming liberal from Maine.
Yes, and she's very interesting, because she was one of the people who really helped defeat the repeal of the ACA back in the summer, but then she ended up voting for this tax bill. And now she's wavering again, because it turns out that she's probably not going to end up with what they told her she was going to get in order to get her vote.
Joe, you told me a story about, I think it was a man who had ALS and had conversations with a congressperson that I think is worth repeating, if you could go into the details of that a bit.
Sure. So it was actually when we were in Washington earlier this week, this man is a member, his name is Adie, I believe, and he's a member of Center for Popular Democracy. And he was flying back out to where he lives in California, but he was flying via a flight that stopped off in Arizona, and he happened to be on the flight with Senator Flake. And they also happened to have another person who works with him at Center for Popular Democracy who video recorded the conversation they had. So this man was fairly recently diagnosed with ALS, and he has a young child. And one of the reasons that he was doing civil disobedience in D.C. is because with the cuts to, you know, the repeal of the individual mandate and the cuts to health insurance and the potential cuts to social services, he's worried that if this bill goes through, he will not be able to afford health care for himself and he will not be able to take care of his child. So he ended up having an 11-minute conversation with Flake. And, you know, Flake didn't outright say, oh, you changed my mind, I'm going to vote no. But he really listened to him, and they had a very productive conversation. So this conversation is actually, the person who recorded it put it up online. I believe it's on Facebook. And people are now using this and contacting Flake and saying, listen to him. Mm-hmm. You know, you heard what he said. He told you he could die if this bill is passed. So there are things like that. We have a little bit of hope that we might be able to still win over some of these representatives using personal stories like that.
You know, it's interesting in that particular encounter. I think the AD said to Flake that because of the PAYGO provision in the rules now, that there will be automatic cuts to Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And Flake said, well, I've been given personal assurance by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell that they're not going to do that. They're going to waive that. And so again, you know, as with Susan Collins in Maine, you know, these sort of little personal asides from one senator or another. These are the things upon which these senators, these very naive,
yes,
fresh-faced, innocent senators are claiming to base their votes. It's pretty disingenuous.
Yes, absolutely. They're being promised these things individually, even though Paul Ryan is outright pretty much saying that the next thing he's going to do is entitlement reform.
Which is code word for entitlement major cuts.
Right.
And there's also another provision, chain CPI, which is something we've talked about on the air, and that chain CPI will reduce everyone's benefits. And that's something that was in the mix for a deal when Obama was president, and the Republicans put that in to some of the tax language here in this current bill, and there's no doubt they have the votes to put it through, which will reduce benefits substantially for people all across the country.
Yes.
I don't know if you've been on the front line in terms of getting arrested, but can you give those of us who are considering such involvement, what's it like to get arrested in D.C.?
So I've been arrested in D.C. now 3 times. I went a few times over the summer, again, fighting for Medicaid, pretty much, mostly for my students. So this last time especially, it was very interesting because as the Capitol Police was arresting us, they were also thanking us and saying, you know, this government is out of control. Can you guys please keep coming here and doing this? Which was the first time I've had that experience with the police actually thanking us as they're arresting us.
That's
but anyone
something.
Who is considering doing civil disobedience, I do recommend it. It's very empowering. And if you're able, Rise and Resist, if for anyone who's in the New York City area, offers some fantastic civil disobedience training so that you know exactly what to expect. And once you're actually going through it, you don't have to be worried because you know you're with a group of people who will support you and you know what's going to happen.
How much time does it take to get processed in D.C. when you get arrested?
Well, it totally depends partially on how many people are arrested. The more people there are, the longer it will take. But the Capitol Police, they seem to be getting a little better at it. So the first couple of times I went, I was there for 8 or 9 hours waiting to be processed. And this last time it was only, I believe, 2.5 hours.
And how would you compare the donuts in D.C. to those at the NYPD?
I, You know, I wasn't offered any of the donuts either time, so...
Bring your own.
I can't really tell you.
I just want to express my gratitude not only for your putting your body where your convictions are. I'm not in a position to do that myself, and I'm really grateful when other people do. But I also really appreciate, and I think you might make more of it in your public face, the training for resistors. Because I know back in the days when I was more actively engaged, one of the keys to the protest movement of the 60s was training of protesters so that they understood what to do and what not to do and what to do once they got arrested. So I would like to hear that more in the public voice of the organization's organizing efforts, that you're not going to just come. You will know what's going on.
Yes, it definitely makes a major difference. And in Rise and Resist, we have a group of people who were members of ACT UP, fighting the AIDS crisis. And those are the people who, they're extremely experienced, and they lead our trainings. And it's just, it makes such a big difference knowing exactly what the process could be like or what the different scenarios could be. It really makes a big difference. So
absolutely.
For anyone who's in the New York City area, I highly recommend looking up. You can search Rise and Resist on Facebook and see our upcoming events if there are any trainings coming up. Or riseandresist.org, sign up for the mailing list on the website.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. And I think I speak for our entire panel and many of our listeners who greatly admire what you've been doing on behalf of your students and public education and all the folks at Rise and Resist and the other groups you mentioned, Housing Works and Center for Popular Democracy, all engaged in the fight to prevent this horrible tax bill from being passed into law. So thanks again for being here, Joe. We all appreciate what you're doing.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me and helping to spread the word.
Thanks. Good night. Well, Lord, good after. Good morning. What time is it?
It's very dark out. It's snowing right now.
It is dark. Okay. Thanks, Joe. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Thank you.
That's Joe Macciarolo, and she's an activist and organizer with the group Rise and Resist, based in New York City. You can find them on the net.
By the way, we had talked a little bit before the show about, well, where's the pushback in Connecticut on these issues, and are we participating in any activism about the tax bill? And, you know, in our state, we have 5 congressional representatives who all voted against the bill, as did our senators. So we kind of... Oftentimes in Connecticut, we feel a little bit we're kind of a progressive team without a mission. But actually, if you check Action Together Connecticut on Facebook, I saw, I think yesterday I noticed that they're going to have a phone bank to be calling Susan Collins and other senators and representatives around the country. And that is Sunday, this Sunday, tomorrow, I think in the afternoon, 3 o'clock or something. So check Facebook for that. And I think you can just plug into that, possibly from your own home phone.
And I think what things that Joe was mentioning that they do is they call progressive activists in other states and have those, the actual constituents of these legislators, call their own legislators, you know. But so there is a role for people in a state like Connecticut where you're not. Have a target, legislator who's voting the wrong way.
Meanwhile, I think there's nothing wrong with calling our representatives and senators and saying, you're doing a very good job, because they know what they need to do. But I think hearing from their constituents that this is the right thing and that they have the support of the public is really important, especially if the more the pressure is put on to compromise and be the good party and be the grown-ups and all that. I don't have any fears that my representatives are going to cave to that, but just the same, it's nice, I think, for them to know, to hear occasionally that really we do approve of what they're doing.
You're listening to Resistance Roundtable here on listener-sponsored WPKN Radio, and we're here... What is it? We're here the second Saturday of each month, 10 to 11 a.m., and... we're here with Richard Hill, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, and myself, Scott Harris.
And just to remind you that our shows are all archived and become podcasts pretty quickly after that. And they're available through our WPKN website. Just go to WPKN.org. Look in the upper left-hand corner. You'll see a podcast link. It'll take you a couple of clicks to get through to SoundCloud, which is really the best reservoir for them. And just search playlists, and you'll find the Resistance Roundtable with probably now about 15 shows there, including this latest one, which will be up there probably by tomorrow night. So now we have approximately 10 minutes, balance of our show, to open our phones and interact with you, the listener, on any issue you'd like to talk about. But we thought that we could maybe start that, open that door by raising the question of this wave of resignations and Me Too proclamations and outings of sexual harassers and sexual abusers that has been sweeping the country and the world. And just to raise that question and give our own assessment and perspective on it, yes.
I just want to give the phone number out.
Certainly.
For people who might want to check in with us on this or any other topic related to resistance. Our phone number here at PKN is 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756.
So, I don't know, Ruth, you want to start? Or?
Well, I've lost a couple of Facebook friends over this over this issue already. I have some real fears about what is happening. And this morning I was reading the New York Times and read a letter that seemed to pinpoint the problem I'm having with it. And I am a person who signed hashtag Me Too, but I didn't really sign it as somebody who wanted to go on the march against, well, Anne Breckenridge, writing from California to the New York Times, wrote this, and I think it is pretty much in line with my point of view. She writes, "Every woman alive, although some of us are more fragile and sensitive than others, knows the difference between an advance from a man that threatens our career and livelihood unless we comply, and a sloppy, silly come-on that is just stupid bad judgment on the part of the guy. We also understand when the advance goes from sloppy and stupid to the use of physical force. Many of us have experienced rape, an entirely different order of violation. There are degrees and degrees of male sexual malfeasance. The continuum is radically different from one end to the other. This has to be acknowledged, or we are on a path to moral chaos in the area of relationships between the sexes. I don't know exactly where the line is, but I know that there is a line." And I've been looking at the fact that just about every crime you can commit in the United States has degrees of seriousness, and the punishment for that crime also has degrees of punishment that go that are commensurate with the level of crime that you are convicted of. And my concern is that in the conversation right now and the reaction right now, especially from the left, we don't seem to be interested in degrees. And I teach writing, I teach literature, I believe in nuance. And I think if we can't deal with nuance, what we do is trivialize the serious cases and over-aggrandize the less serious cases. If we can't articulate exactly what we're talking about, I think we're going to be in big trouble.
I would just say, and just a small point that I would agree with Ruth Ann, is that while this conversation that has exploded over recent months is important and the right thing to do, I think due process has to be observed. And that's not an excuse for the justified reaction of revulsion of some of the behavior of our politicians and people in Hollywood and in media. But due process is called for in anything that we do in terms of the workplace or any kind of malfeasance or misconduct by people wherever they are. So I think that's something we can all agree on. There
Absolutely.
Has to be a process and not just, you know, marching with torches to burn down someone's house. We got to go through a process here.
As a matter of fact, the physician who was treating the American Olympic gymnasts went through due process, and he's just been sentenced to 60-some years in jail. And he's over 50 now, so that's the equivalent of a life sentence. And this was done judicially and with evidence. It wasn't just done from our gut. If we have any belief in the honor of the institutions that we've put in place over the years, we have to let them work.
And due process has to be observed in order to avoid the kind of mindless false equivalencies that we're getting between, let's say, the behavior of Al Franken, which is, has to be condemned, and the detestable, you know, just criminal behavior of somebody like Roy Moore in Alabama that the Republicans have rallied behind, most of them. Sickening. Sickening.
Yeah, I think we might stress some of the things that Roy Moore has already been convicted of in our discussion, too, because his defiance of federal law is should itself be grounds to disqualify him from service in any kind of legal position.
Well, I certainly agree on the due process issue. And, you know, just to give an example of somebody who I do not admire and am happy to actually to see replaced by Christian Amanpour is Charlie Rose, who I regarded as sort of a jabbering, sycophantic dandy, faux journalist.
I like that, Richard. Good.
You left out FOP.
No. Yeah, who has been really, really gumming up PBS for a long time. But the guy's been there for 25 years, and based on several accusations, or maybe six or nine, I don't know how many, one day he was there and the next day he wasn't. What would have been remiss about saying, okay, Charlie Rose, we're going to suspend you while we investigate these accusations and make sure that it's not just somebody dropping a dime on you who doesn't like you and wants to get you off the air. Because I think this is the issue, is that this kind of process or lack of process is opening up the possibility for political chicanery to happen, and which I think a lot of progressives felt was the case with Al Franken. I know of several people, friends of mine, who said when the first accusation happened, they said, oh, she's a right-wing activist. Well, how do we know unless we check it out? Anybody from anywhere can end somebody's career peremptorily. And it's interesting, by the way, that Jane Mayer and Rebecca Traister and Masha Gessen have come out with pretty nuanced analyses of this question. And they, too, have suggested that there's something lacking in what's happening, and that it's opening up this movement to accusations of Salem witch trials and lynch mob, which we're hearing from all quarters, including right-wing quarters. So those are my thoughts, and amazed that we haven't gotten a call on this yet, because this is a pretty hot-button issue.
Well, I think we have one right now.
All so. Right. Let's
see. Hi, WPKN, you're on the air.
Thank you. Basically, with so little time and so much to talk about, I just do want to thank you all for having this program. It's important. I wish we could get a lot more public opinion into these things. There are so many topics. We have to focus on the one central thing. We have to learn how to vote. I don't know what it takes. I don't know why we don't do it. But that's the way out. And if we don't change the way we vote and the way we use our power as a voter, it's never going to happen. It's simply never going to happen. We're talking about a raising of consciousness here, not just political consciousness, but the very spirit that we live by. And I think it's important that we don't lose that. I don't know where the man at the top is getting all this information from. He certainly has become an expert on everything suddenly, and I don't know how that's happened. But in any event, we have an election coming up next year, and I just hope we participate. Thank you again for your program. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you so much.
We have the best listeners and callers here on
the
station.
Absolutely. That right there was the answer to all the people who've lately been saying, we need term limits. We need term limits. Term limits will fix everything. Term limits mean I don't have to think at all. If I don't like the way things are, I can just sit back for a few years, and then they'll change. They'll have to change. So the job of the citizen is a serious job, and I was delighted to hear the caller say that.
Me too. They said it well. Richard, any closing thoughts here?
Not necessarily. I kind of emptied my cash for the day, but the carnival rolls on, and the carnival barker, I'm sure, will be barking in the interim weeks, and we're only here once a month, but the podcast can make it be a bigger process. So thank you all for listening, and we'll be back second Saturday of January.